in fact, he was his own best subject, reporting in the 1923 paper that he was, at 35, in fair general training owing to a daily slow run of about 1 mile before breakfast. He was also an enthusiastic competitor in track and cross-country races. Indeed, to tell the truth, it may well have been my struggles and failures on track and field, and the stiffness and exhaustion that sometimes befell, which led me to ask many questions which I have attempted to answer here. The experiments on Hill and his colleagues involved running in tight circles around an 85-meter grass loop in Hill's garden. A standard track in comparison is 400 meters long, with an airbag strapped to their backs connected to a breathing apparatus to measure their oxygen consumption. The faster they ran, the more oxygen they consumed, up to a point. Eventually, they reported oxygen intake reaches a maximum beyond which no effort can drive it. Crucially, they could still accelerate to faster speeds. However, their oxygen intake no longer followed. This plateau is your VO2 max, a pure and objective measure of endurance capacity that is, in theory, independent of motivation, weather, phase of the moon, or any other possible excuse. Hill surmised that VO2 max reflected the ultimate limits of the heart and circulatory system, a measurable constant that seemed to reveal the size of the engine an athlete was blessed with. With this advance, Hill now had the means to calculate the theoretical maximum performance of any runner at any distance. At low speeds, the effort is primarily aerobic, meaning with oxygen. Since oxygen is required for the most efficient conversion of stored food energy into a form your muscles can use, your VO2 max reflects your aerobic limits. At higher speeds, your legs demand energy at a rate that aerobic processes can't match. So, you have to draw on fast-burning anaerobic, without oxygen, energy sources. The problem, as Hopkins and Fletcher had shown in 1907, is that muscles contracting without oxygen generate lactic acid. Your muscle's ability to tolerate high levels of lactic acid, what we would now call anaerobic capacity, is the other key determinant of endurance, Hill concluded, particularly in events lasting less than about 10 minutes. In his 20s, Hill reported, he had run best times of 53 seconds for the quarter mile, 2 minutes 3 seconds for the half mile, 4 minutes 45 seconds for the mile, and 10 minutes 30 seconds for 2 miles. Creditable times for the era, though he modestly emphasized not first class. Or rather, in keeping with scientific practice at the time, these feats were attributed to an anonymous subject known as H, who happened to be the same age and speed as Hill. The exhaustive tests in his back garden showed that his VO2 max was 4.0 liters of oxygen per minute, and his lactic acid tolerance would allow him to accumulate a further oxygen debt of about 10 liters. Using these numbers, along with measurements of his running efficiency, he could plot a graph that predicted his best race times with surprising accuracy. Hill shared these results enthusiastically. "Our bodies are machines whose energy expenditures may be closely measured," he declared in a 1926 Scientific American article titled "The Scientific Study of Athletics." He published an analysis of world records in running, swimming, cycling, rowing, and skating at distances ranging from 100 yards to 100 miles. For the shortest sprints, the shape of the world record curve was apparently dictated by muscle viscosity, which Hill studied during a stint at Cornell University by strapping a dull magnetized hacksaw blade around the chest of a sprinter, who then ran past a series of coiled wire electromagnets, a remarkable early system for precision electric timing. At longer distances, lactic acid and then VO2 max bent the world record curve just as predicted. But there was a mystery at the longest distances. Hill's calculations suggested that if the speed was slow enough, your heart and lungs should be able to deliver enough oxygen to your muscles to keep them fully aerobic. There should be a pace, in other words, that you could sustain pretty much indefinitely. Instead, the data showed a steady decline. The 100-mile running record was substantially slower than the 50-mile record, which in turn was slower than the 25-mile record. Consideration merely of oxygen intake and oxygen debt will not suffice to explain the continued fall of the curve, Hill acknowledged. He penciled in a dashed near-horizontal line showing where he thought the ultra-distance records ought to be, and concluded that the longer records were weaker primarily because the greatest athletes have confined themselves to distances not greater than 10 miles. By the time Henry Worsley and his companions finally reached the South Pole in 2009, they had skied 920 miles, towing sleds that initially weighed 300 pounds. Entering the final week, Worsley knew that his margin of error had all but evaporated. At 48, he was a decade older than either Adams or Gao, and by the end of each day's ski, he was struggling to keep up with them. On New Year's Day, with 125 miles still to go, he turned down Adams's offer to take some weight off his sled. Instead, he buried his emergency backup rations in the snow, a calculated risk in exchange for a savings of 18 pounds. Soon I was finding each hour a worrying struggle, and was starting to become very conscious of my weakening condition, he recalled. He began to lag behind and arrive at camp 10 to 15 minutes after the others. On the eve of their final push to the pole, Worsley took a solitary walk outside the tent, as he'd done every evening throughout the trip, before crawling into his sleeping bag. Over the course of the journey, he had sometimes spent these quiet moments contemplating the jagged glaciers they had just traversed and distant mountains still to come. Other times the view was simply a never-ending expanse of nothingness. On this final night, he was greeted by a spectacular display in the polar twilight. The sun was shaped like a diamond, surrounded by an incandescent circle of white-hot light, and flanked on either side by matching sun dogs, an effect created when the sun's rays are refracted by a haze of prism-shaped ice crystals. It was the first clear display of sun dogs during the entire journey. Surely, Worsley told himself, this was an omen, a sign from the Antarctic that it was finally releasing its grip on him. The next day was anticlimactic, a leisurely 5-mile coda to their epic trip before entering the warm embrace of the Amundsen Scott South Pole Station. They had done it, and Worsley was flooded with a sense of relief and accomplishment. The Antarctic, though, was not yet finished with him, after all. Worsley had spent 3 decades in the British Army, including tours in the Balkans and Afghanistan, with the Elite Special Air Service, SAS, the equivalent of America's SEALs or Delta Force. He rode a Harley, taught needlepoint to prison inmates, and had faced a stone-throwing mob in Bosnia. The polar voyage, though, had captivated him. It demanded every ounce of his reserves, and in doing so, it expanded his conception of what he was capable of. In challenging the limits of his own endurance, he had finally found a worthy adversary. Worsley was hooked. 3 years later, in late 2011, Worsley returned to the Antarctic for a centenary reenactment of Robert Falcon Scott and Roald Amundsen's Race to the South Pole. Amundsen's team, skiing along an eastern route with 52 dogs that hauled sleds and eventually served as food, famously reached the pole on December 14, 1911. Scott's team, struggling over the longer route that Shackleton had blazed, with malfunctioning mechanical sleds and Manchurian ponies that couldn't handle the ice and cold, reached it 34 days later, only to find Amundsen's tent, along with a polite note awaiting them. As you probably are the first to reach this area after us, I will ask you kindly to forward this letter to King Haakon VII. If you can use any of the articles left in the tent, please do not hesitate to do so. The sledge left outside may be of use to you. With kind regards, I wish you a safe return. While Amundsen's return journey was uneventful, Scott's harrowing ordeal showed just what was at stake. A combination of bad weather, bad luck, and shoddy equipment, combined with a botched scientific calculation of their calorie needs, left Scott and his men too weak to make it back. Starving and frostbitten, they lay in their tent for 10 snowy days, unable to cover the final 11 miles to their food depot, before dying. A century later, Worsley led a team of 6 soldiers along Amundsen's route, becoming the first man to complete both classic routes to the pole. Still, he wasn't done. In 2015, he returned for yet another centenary reenactment, this time of the Imperial Transantarctic Expedition, Shackleton's most famous and most brutally demanding voyage of all. In 1909, Shackleton's prudent decision to turn back short of the pole had undoubtedly saved him and his men. But it was still a perilously close call. Their ship had been instructed to wait until March 1st. Shackleton and one other man reached a nearby point late on February 28th and lit a wooden weather station on fire to get the ship's attention and signal for rescue. In the years after this brush with disaster, and with Amundsen having claimed the South Pole bragging rights in 1911, Shackleton at first resolved not to return to the southern continent at all. But like Worsley, he couldn't stay away. Shackleton's new plan was to make the first complete crossing of the Antarctic continent from the Weddell Sea near South America to the Ross Sea near New Zealand. En route to the start, his ship, the Endurance, was seized by the ice of the Weddell Sea, forcing Shackleton and his men to spend the winter of 1915 on the frozen expanse. The ship was eventually crushed by shifting ice, forcing the men to embark on a now legendary odyssey that climaxed with Shackleton leading an 800-mile crossing over some of the roughest seas on Earth in an open lifeboat. To rugged South Georgia Island, where there was a tiny whaling station from which they could call for rescue. The navigator behind this remarkable feat? Frank Worsley, Henry Worsley's forebear, and the origin of his obsession. While the original expedition failed to achieve any of its goals, the 3-year saga ended up providing one of the most gripping tales of endurance from the great age of exploration. Edmund Hillary, conqueror of Mount Everest, called it the greatest survival story of all time, and again earned Shackleton praise for bringing his men home safely. 3 men did die on the other half of the expedition, laying in supplies at the trek's planned finishing point. Once more, Worsley decided to complete his hero's unfinished business. But this would be different. His previous polar treks had covered only half the actual distance, since he had flown home from the South Pole both times. Completing the full journey wouldn't just add more distance and weight to haul, it would also make it correspondingly harder to judge the fine line between stubborn persistence and recklessness. In 1909, Shackleton had turned back not because he couldn't reach the pole, but because he feared he and his men wouldn't make it back home. In 1912, Scott had chosen to push on and paid the ultimate price. This time, Worsley resolved to complete the entire 1,100-mile continental crossing, and to do it alone, unsupported, unpowered, hauling all his gear behind him. On November 13th, he set off on skis from the southern tip of Berkner Island, 100 miles off the Antarctic coast, towing a 330-pound sled across the frozen sea. That night, in the daily audio diary he uploaded to the web throughout the trip, he described the sounds he had become so familiar with on his previous expeditions, the squeak of the ski poles gliding into the snow, the thud of the sledge over each bump, and the swish of the skis sliding along. And then when you stop, the unbelievable silence. At first, A.V. Hill's attempts to calculate the limits of human performance were met with bemusement. In 1924, he traveled to Philadelphia to give a lecture at the Franklin Institute on the mechanism of muscle. At the end, he later recalled, I was asked rather indignantly by an elderly gentleman what use I supposed all these investigations were which I had been describing. Hill first tried to explain the practical benefits that might follow from studying athletes, but soon decided that honesty was the best policy. To tell you the truth, he admitted, we don't do it because it is useful, but because it's amusing. That was the headline in the newspaper the next day. Scientist does it because it's amusing. In reality, the practical and commercial value of Hill's work was obvious right from the start. His VO2 max studies were funded by Britain's Industrial Fatigue Research Board, which also employed his two co-authors. What better way to squeeze the maximum productivity from workers than by calculating their physical limits and figuring out how to extend them? Other labs around the world soon began pursuing similar goals. The Harvard Fatigue Laboratory, for example, was established in 1927 to focus on industrial hygiene, with the aim of studying the various causes and manifestations of fatigue, to determine their interrelatedness and the effect upon work. The Harvard lab went on to produce some of the most famous and groundbreaking studies of record-setting athletes, but its primary mission of enhancing workplace productivity was signaled by its location, in the basement of the Harvard Business School. Citing Hill's research as his inspiration, the head of the Harvard lab, David Bruce Dill, figured that understanding what made top athletes unique would shed light on the more modest limits faced by everyone else. Secret of Clarence DeMar's endurance discovered in the fatigue laboratory, the Harvard Crimson announced in 1930, reporting on a study in which 24 volunteers had run on a treadmill for 20 minutes before having the chemical composition of their blood analyzed. By the end of the test, DeMar, a 7-time Boston Marathon champion, had produced almost no lactic acid, a substance that, according to Dill's view at the time, leaks out into the blood, producing or tending to produce exhaustion. In later studies, Dill and his colleagues tested the effects of diet on blood sugar levels in Harvard football players before, during, and after games, and studied runners like Glenn Cunningham and Don Lash. The reigning world record holders at 1 mile and 2 miles, reporting their remarkable oxygen processing capacities in a paper titled New Records in Human Power. Are such insights about endurance on the track or the gridiron really applicable to endurance in the workplace? Dill and his colleagues certainly thought so. They drew an explicit link between the biochemical steady state of athletes like DeMar, who could run at an impressive clip for extended periods of time without obvious signs of fatigue, and the capacity of well-trained workers to put in long hours under stressful conditions without a decline in performance. At the time, labor experts were debating two conflicting views of fatigue in the workplace. As MIT historian Robin Scheffler recounts, efficiency gurus like Frederick Winslow Taylor argued that the only true limits on the productive power of workers were inefficiency and lack of will, the toddlers on a plane kind of endurance. Labor reformers, meanwhile, insisted that the human body, like an engine, could produce only a certain amount of work before requiring a break, like, say, a weekend? The experimental results emerging from the Harvard Fatigue Lab offered a middle ground, acknowledging the physiological reality of fatigue, but suggesting it could be avoided if workers stayed in physico-chemical equilibrium, the equivalent of DeMar's ability to run without accumulating excessive lactic acid. Dill tested these ideas in various extreme environments, studying oxygen-starved Chilean miners at 20,000 feet above sea level, and jungle heat in the Panama Canal Zone. Most famously, he and his colleagues studied laborers working on the Hoover Dam, a great Depression-era megaproject employing thousands of men in the Mojave Desert. During the first year of construction in 1931, 13 workers died of heat exhaustion. When Dill and his colleagues arrived the following year, they tested the workers before and after grueling 8-hour shifts in the heat, showing that their levels of sodium and other electrolytes were depleted, a telling departure from physico-chemical equilibrium. The fix? One of Dill's colleagues persuaded the company doctor to amend a sign in the dining hall that said, "The surgeon says drink plenty of water," adding, "and put plenty of salt on your food." No more men died of heat exhaustion during the subsequent 4 years of construction, and the widely publicized results helped enshrine the importance of salt in fighting heat and dehydration. Even though, as Dill repeatedly insisted in later years, the biggest difference from 1931 to 32 was moving the men's living quarters from encampments on the sweltering canyon floor to air-conditioned dormitories on the plateau. If there was any remaining doubt about Hill's vision of the human machine, the arrival of World War II in 1939 helped to erase it. As Allied soldiers, sailors, and airmen headed into battle around the world, scientists at Harvard and elsewhere studied the effects of heat, humidity, dehydration, starvation, altitude, and other stressors on their performance, and searched for practical ways of boosting endurance under these conditions. To assess subtle changes in physical capacity, researchers needed an objective measure of endurance, and Hill's concept of VO2 max fit the bill. The most notorious of these wartime studies at the University of Minnesota's Laboratory of Physical Hygiene involved 36 conscientious objectors, men who had refused on principle to serve in the armed forces, but had volunteered instead for a grueling experiment. Led by Ansel Keys, the influential researcher who had developed the K-ration for soldiers and who went on to propose a link between dietary fat and heart disease, the Minnesota Starvation Study put the volunteers through 6 months of semi-starvation, eating an average 1,570 calories in two meals each day, while working for 15 hours and walking 22 miles per week. In previous VO2 max studies, scientists had trusted that they could simply ask their subjects to run to exhaustion in order to produce maximal values. But with men who've been through the physical and psychological torment of months of starvation, there is good reason for not trusting the subject's willingness to push himself to the point at which a maximal oxygen intake is elicited, Key's colleague Henry Longstreet Taylor dryly noted. Taylor and two other scientists took on the task of developing a test protocol that would eliminate both motivation and skill as limiting factors in objectively assessing endurance. They settled on a treadmill test, in which the grade got progressively steeper, with carefully controlled warm-up duration and room temperature. When subjects were tested and retested even a year later, their results were remarkably stable. Your VO2 max was your VO2 max, regardless of how you felt that day or whether you were giving your absolute best. Taylor's description of this protocol, published in 1955, marked the real start of the VO2 max era. By the 1960s, growing faith in the scientific measurement of endurance led to a subtle reversal. Instead of testing great athletes to learn about their physiology, scientists were using physiological testing to predict who could be a great athlete. South African researcher Cyril Windham argued that men must have certain minimum physiological requirements if they are to reach, say, an Olympic final. Rather than sending South African runners all the way across the world only to come up short, he suggested, they should first be tested in the lab so that conclusions can be drawn on the question of whether the Republic's top athletes have sufficient horsepower to compete with the world's best. In some ways, the man-as-machine view had now been pushed far beyond what Hill initially envisioned. There is, of course, much more in athletics than sheer chemistry, Hill had cheerfully acknowledged, noting the importance of moral factors, those qualities of resolution and experience which enable one individual to run himself out to a far greater degree of exhaustion than another. But the urge to focus on the quantifiable at the expense of the seemingly abstract was understandably strong. Scientists gradually fine-tuned their models of endurance by incorporating other physiological traits, like economy and fractional utilization, along with VO2 max, the equivalent of considering a car's fuel economy and the size of its gas tank, in addition to its raw horsepower. It was in this context that Michael Joyner proposed his now famous 1991 thought experiment on the fastest possible marathon. As a restless undergraduate in the late 1970s, Joyner had been on the verge of dropping out of the University of Arizona. At 6'5" and with physical endurance that eventually enabled him to run a 2-hour, 25-minute marathon, he figured he might make a pretty good firefighter. When he was outkicked at the end of a 10K race by a grad student from the school's exercise and sports science laboratory. After the race, the student convinced Joyner to volunteer as a guinea pig in one of the lab's ongoing experiments, a classic study that ended up demonstrating that lactate threshold, the fastest speed you can maintain without triggering a dramatic rise in blood lactate levels, is a remarkably accurate predictor of marathon time. The seed was planted, and Joyner was soon volunteering at the lab and embarking on the first stages of an unexpected new career trajectory that eventually led to a position as physician researcher at the Mayo Clinic, where he is now one of the world's most widely cited experts on the limits of human performance. That first study on lactate threshold offered Joyner a glimpse of physiology's predictive power. The fact that such an arcane lab test could pick the winner, or at least the general gist of finishing order, among a group of endurance athletes was a tantalizing prospect. And when, a decade later, Joyner finally pushed this train of thought to its logical extreme, he arrived at a very specific number. 1 hour, 57 minutes, 58 seconds. It was a ridiculous, laughable number, a provocation. Either the genetics needed to produce such a performance were exceedingly rare, he wrote in the paper's conclusions, or our level of knowledge about the determinants of human performance is inadequate. By day 56, the relentless physical demands of Henry Worsley's solo transantarctic trek were taking a toll. He woke that morning feeling weaker than he'd felt at any point in the expedition, his strength sapped by a restless night repeatedly interrupted by a bad stomach. He set off as usual, but gave up after an hour and slept for the rest of the day. You have to listen to your body sometimes, he admitted in his audio diary. Still, he was more than 200 miles from his destination and already behind his planned schedule. So he roused himself that night, packed up his tent, and set off again at 10 minutes after midnight under the unblinking polar sun. He was approaching the high point of the journey, slogging up a massive ice ridge known as the Titan Dome, more than 10,000 feet above sea level. The thin air forced him to take frequent breaks to catch his breath, and a stretch of sandy, blowing snow bogged his sled down and slowed his progress for several hours. By 4 p.m., having covered 16 miles in 16 hours, he was once again utterly spent. He had hoped to cross from the 89th degree of southern latitude, the one closest to the South Pole, into the 88th, but he was forced to stop 1 mile short of his goal. There was nothing left in the tank, he reported. I had completely run empty. The next day was January 9th, the day that Shackleton had famously turned back from his South Pole quest in 1909. A live donkey is better than a dead lion, isn't it? Shackleton had said to his wife when he returned to England. Worsley was camped just 34 miles from Shackleton's turnaround latitude, and he marked the anniversary with a small cigar, which he chomped with a gap-toothed grin, having lost a front tooth to a frozen energy bar a few days earlier, and a dram of Dewar's Royal Brackla Scotch whiskey, a bottle of which he had hauled across the continent. Of the many advantages Worsley had over Shackleton, perhaps the most powerful was the Iridium satellite phone he carried in his pack, with which he could choose at any moment to call for an air evacuation. But this blessing was also a curse. In calculating his limits, Shackleton had been forced to leave a margin of error due to the impossibility of predicting how the return journey would go. Worsley's access to near instantaneous help, on the other hand, allowed him to push much closer to the margins, to empty his tank day after day, after struggling through the snow for 12, 14, or 16 hours, to ignore his increasing weakness and 50-pound weight loss, to fight on even as the odds tilted further against him. Eventually, it became clear that he wouldn't make it to his scheduled pickup. He'd been trying to log 16-hour days to get back on schedule, but soft snow and whiteouts combined with his continuing physical deterioration to derail him. He contemplated a shorter goal, of reaching the Shackleton Glacier. But even that proved out of reach. On January 21st, his 70th day of travel, he made the call. When my hero, Ernest Shackleton, stood 97 nautical miles from the South Pole on the morning on January 9th, 1909, he said he'd shot his bolt, Worsley reported in his audio diary. Well, today I have to inform you, with some sadness, that I too have shot my bolt. My journey is at an end, I've run out of time, physical endurance, and the simple sheer ability to slide one ski in front of the other. The next day, he was picked up for the 6-hour flight back to Union Glacier, where logistical support for Antarctic expeditions is based, and then airlifted to the hospital in Punta Arenas, Chile, to be treated for exhaustion and dehydration. It was a disappointing end to the expedition, but Worsley appeared to have successfully followed Shackleton's advice to remain a live donkey. In the hospital, though, the situation took an unexpected turn. Worsley was diagnosed with bacterial peritonitis, an infection of the abdominal lining, and rushed into surgery. On January 24th, at the age of 55, Henry Worsley died of widespread organ failure, leaving behind a wife and 2 children. When avalanches claim a skier, or sharks attack a surfer, or a puff of unexpected wind dooms a wingsuit flyer, it's always news. Like these other extreme deaths, Worsley's tragic end was reported and discussed around the world. There was a difference, though. There had been no avalanche, no large, hungry predator, no high-speed impact. He didn't freeze to death, he wasn't lost, and he still had plenty of food to eat. Though it may never be clear exactly what pushed him over the edge, he seemed, in essence, to have voluntarily driven himself to oblivion, a rarity that added a grim fascination to his demise. In Exploring the Outer Limits of Endurance, Britain's Guardian newspaper asked, did Worsley not realize he'd surpassed his own? In a sense, Worsley's death seemed a vindication of the mathematical view of human limits. The machinery of the body is all of a chemical or physical kind. It will all be expressed someday in physical and chemical terms, Hill had predicted in 1927. And every machine, no matter how great, has a maximum capacity. Worsley, in trying to cross Antarctica on his own, had embarked on a mission that exceeded his body's capacity, and no amount of mental strength and tenacity could change that calculation. But if that's true, then why is death by endurance so rare? Why don't Olympic marathoners and channel swimmers and Appalachian trail hikers keel over on a regular basis? That's the riddle a young South African doctor named Tim Noakes posed to himself as he was preparing to deliver the most important talk of his life, a prestigious honorary lecture at the annual meeting of the American College of Sports Medicine in 1996. I said, now, hold on. What is really interesting about exercise is not that people die of, say, heat stroke or when people are climbing Everest. It's not that 1 or 2 die, he later recalled. The fact is, the majority don't die, and that is much more interesting. Chapter 3. The Central Governor. To catch the ferry, Diane Van Deren needed to cover 36 miles in just over 8 hours. That would normally be no problem for the veteran ultra-runner, except, in this case, for the unforgiving terrain, the torrential rain, and sumo force winds left in the wake of Tropical Storm Beryl, and the fatigue and horrendous blisters accrued over the first 19 days and 900 miles of the mountains-to-sea trail across North Carolina. Worse, Van Deren was startled to hear a savage and malicious roar from the darkness to her right. "What is that?" she yelled to her trail guide, Chuck Millsaps, the owner of a local outfitting company. "It was just an airplane," he assured her. But to be safe, they strapped themselves together for mutual safety as they prepared to cross a wind-whipped bridge. At stake in all the chaos was Van Deren's attempt to set a new record for the 1,000-mile trail. If they missed the 1 p.m. ferry from Cedar Island to Ocracoke, the mark of 24 days, 3 hours, and 50 minutes would be out of reach. The 52-year-old Coloradan was a connoisseur of the slow-drip torture of ultra-endurance challenges. She had pulled a 45-pound sled 430 miles across the frozen tundra to win the Yukon Arctic Ultra. Second place was, well, no other woman finished. Scaled the 22,838-foot peak of Aconcagua as part of a Mayo Clinic research expedition studying human limits, and racked up top finishes at grueling races of 100 miles or more around the world. Making the ferry, though, would require squeezing a relative sprint from her battered legs. She'd been running from dawn to near dawn for almost 3 weeks, sleeping 1 to 3 hours a night, barely pausing to let her North Face-supported crew team duct-tape her blistered feet and cram food into her mouth. Fortunately, Van Deren had an advantage, or at least a unique quirk that seemed to help her push past the corporeal limits that drag down most would-be ultramarathoners. At 37, she had undergone elective brain surgery to remove a golf ball-sized chunk of her temporal cortex, the focal point of epileptic seizures that had plagued her as often as 2 or 3 times a week for years. The surgery successfully stopped the seizures, but also left her with neurological deficits, poor memory, an impaired sense of direction, difficulty keeping track of time. A 2011 Runner's World profile dubbed her the Disoriented Express, noting that in races she must cover hundreds of miles and yet often has no idea how long she has been running. A significant handicap, you'd think. And yet, it was only after the surgery that her racing career even started. To understand her extraordinary endurance, in other words, start with her brain. The brain's role in endurance is perhaps the single most controversial topic in sports science. It's not that anyone thinks the brain doesn't matter. Everyone, right back to A.V. Hill and other pioneers of the body as machine view, has always understood that the race is not always to the swift, particularly if the swift make bad tactical decisions, pace themselves poorly, or simply are unwilling to suffer. In that view, the body sets the limits, and the brain dictates how close you get to those boundaries. But starting in the late 1990s, a South African physician and scientist named Tim Noakes began to argue that this picture is insufficiently radical, that it's actually the brain alone that sets and enforces the seemingly physical limits we encounter during prolonged exercise. The claim has profound and surprising implications, and the extent to which it's true or false remains one of the most volatile flashpoints in exercise physiology 2 decades later. The particular tone of the controversy has as much to do with Noakes himself, an instinctive iconoclast who has been clashing with his scientific peers more or less continuously for 4 decades now, as with his ideas. Tim is probably his own worst enemy, says Carl Foster, the director of the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse's Human Performance Laboratory and a former president of the American College of Sports Medicine, who counts Noakes as a friend. He's a very strong personality, and he gets these really neat, innovative ideas, but instead of saying, "Wow, I found a better way to explain this," he says, "Everybody else is wrong." Noakes, for his part, denies ever saying that everyone else is wrong. "Of course, I believe they are wrong, but I am not about to tell them that," he helpfully clarified in an email. "I just present what I believe is the truth." Either way, Foster acknowledges, if you want to challenge a century's worth of textbook material, maybe that stirring the pot is necessary. Noakes started out as a collegiate rower at the University of Cape Town. but his trajectory was altered one morning in the early 1970s when his rowing practice was canceled due to high winds. His teammates went home, but Noakes decided to stay and run around nearby lake. After 40 minutes, he was overcome by a feeling of euphoria, the classic but elusive runner's high. Thanks in part to this quirk of brain chemistry, he quickly became hooked on the new sport and ultimately shifted his professional interests from clinical medicine to running-related research. He went on to complete more than 70 marathon and ultramarathon races, including 7 finishes at South Africa's famous 56-mile Comrades Marathon. In the lab, meanwhile, his penchant for paradigm rattling, as Foster calls it, emerged early. At a landmark gathering of sports scientists before the 1976 New York Marathon, at the height of the first jogging boom, most of the presentations focused on the incredible health benefits of running. Noakes, in contrast, presented the case report of an experienced marathoner who'd suffered a heart attack, puncturing the then popular notion that marathoners were immune to clogged arteries. In 1981, he reported the case of Eleanor Sadler, a 46-year-old woman who collapsed during the Comrades Marathon and diagnosed her problem as hyponatremia, a result of drinking too much rather than the more common problem of drinking too little. It took another 2 decades and a handful of deaths before the scientific community fully acknowledged the dangers of overdrinking during exercise. That same year, Noakes co-founded a dedicated sports science unit in the basement of the University of Cape Town's physiology department. With a single stationary bicycle and a nearly obsolete treadmill, he and his colleagues began bringing athletes in and testing their maximal oxygen consumption. Because, he says, in 1981, to be a sports scientist, you had to have a VO2 max machine to measure VO2 max. But it didn't take long for Noakes to grow dissatisfied with the insights provided by A.V. Hill's signature measurement. One day in the lab's early years, he tested track star Ricky Robinson and Comrades champion Isabel Roche Kelly less than an hour apart. And despite their vastly different racing speeds, they both recorded the same VO2 max. Noakes' conclusion? Clearly, the VO2 max was totally useless, because here we had a sub-4-minute miler, and it couldn't say he was any better than the lady who could run a 5-minute mile. Over the next decade, Noakes began searching for better ways of predicting and measuring endurance, and other ways of explaining the apparent limits runners like Robinson and Roche Kelly encountered when they finally had to step off the treadmill at the end of a test to exhaustion. Hill and his successors had focused on oxygen. At your limits, your heart was incapable of pumping any more oxygen to your muscles, or your muscles were incapable of extracting any more oxygen from your bloodstream. Noakes' first idea for an alternative to VO2 max in the late 1980s was that the limits might reside in the contractility of the muscle fibers themselves, but that theory fizzled. By the 1990s, Noakes had become an internationally renowned running guru, thanks to the enduring pop-sci classic Lore of Running, a 944-page doorstopper that first appeared in 1985. In 1996, he received one of the highest honors in the field of exercise physiology, an invitation to deliver the J.B. Wolfe Memorial Lecture at the annual meeting of the American College of Sports Medicine. True to his reputation, he decided to harangue his eminent audience about their stubborn adherence to the ugly and creaking edifices of old theories that were unsupported by empirical science. It was in preparing for this talk that he had his crucial epiphany about the rarity of deaths from exhaustion, like Henry Worsley's. Whatever our limits are, something must prevent us from exceeding them by too much, and that something, he reasoned, must be the brain. The history of brain research is in some ways a tale of unfortunate injuries and illnesses. Phineas Gage, for example, was a 25-year-old construction foreman working on a new railway route in 1848 when a misfired explosive blast sent a 43-inch-long tamping iron rocketing up through his cheek and out the top of his skull. His survival was remarkable enough, but even more surprising were the alterations in his personality. A polite, competent man was suddenly transformed through damage to his frontal lobes to a profane and unreliable one. To his friends, the doctor who treated him reported, Gage was no longer Gage. Since then, we've learned a great deal about how the brain works by observing the distinctive changes that follow damage to different parts of the brain, an assortment of strange and mostly sad transformations of the type chronicled with tenderness and humanity by the late neurologist Oliver Sacks. For Diane Van Deren, the first warning signs came when she was just 16 months old, when a prolonged seizure sent her to the hospital, where she lay packed in ice, convulsing, for nearly an hour. There were no apparent after effects, and Van Deren grew up to be a star tennis player, got married, and had children. Then, when she was 29 and pregnant with her third child, the seizures returned, and over the next few years they got progressively worse. Working with neurologists at the University of Colorado, she eventually decided to have a partial right temporal lobectomy, to remove the portion of the brain where the seizures were originating. The surgery went well, and the seizures stopped, but not without a cost. Even before the surgery, Van Deren had found running therapeutic. When she felt an aura, the odd out-of-body sensation that, for her, signaled an impending seizure, she was often able to ward off the seizure by heading out the door and running, sometimes for hours. After the surgery, she kept running and began venturing farther and farther into the trails near her home south of Denver. Soon she was covering distances that would have daunted even the fittest runners. And in 2002, she entered her first ultramarathon, a 50-mile trail run with only one other entrant. The 50-miler turned out to be just a stepping stone to 100-milers, which in turn led to multi-day races like the Yukon Arctic Ultra and eventually the 3-week assault on the Mountains to Sea Trail in North Carolina in 2012. In the final days of the record attempt, Van Deren's feet were so beat up that she had to start each day by crawling along the trail until, thanks to the familiar numbing of endorphins, she could stand up and start putting weight on them. Then she would resume clicking off the miles one by one. By 12:20 p.m. on the 20th day of the run, she and Millsaps were still 4 miles away from the crucial 1 p.m. Ocracoke ferry. So they accelerated. They caught the ferry with just minutes to spare, and the ferry operator solved the mystery of the airplane that had buzzed them earlier. "You must have just come through those tornadoes back there," he marveled. 2 days later, Van Deren climbed an 85-foot sand dune in Jockeys Ridge State Park to complete the trail in a new record of 22 days, 5 hours, and 3 minutes. "That," she told a small crowd of supporters, "is the hardest thing I have ever done." In the Runner's World profile, neuropsychologist Don Gerber, who worked with Van Deren at Craig Hospital in Denver, speculated that brain surgery might have made her a better runner, thanks to the region of her brain that was damaged, he said. "Diane's brain interprets pain differently than yours or mine does." Van Deren, for her part, rejects this suggestion. "They all think, 'Oh, great, you don't feel pain,' she argued in a subsequent profile. Well, shit, I don't feel pain. I feel pain. I just push through it. And indeed, her suffering during the run in North Carolina was evident. Still, it's hard to escape the sense that how Van Deren experiences a prolonged endurance challenge is inescapably different from how it is for most people. Unable to read maps or keep track of where she is on a course, she doesn't focus on the challenge ahead of her. Hampered by poor short-term memory, she doesn't dwell on the effort already expended either. I could be out running for 2 weeks, but if someone told me it was day one of a race, she once joked, I'd be like, great, let's get started. Instead, she has no choice but to focus on the immediate task of forward motion, taking one more step and then another. Semi-oblivious to the passage of time, she is also free of the cognitive challenge, the shackles, perhaps, of pacing herself. She is all hare and no tortoise, which, Aesopian morality aside, has its advantages. To get a visceral feel for the struggle between mind and muscle, there's no better place to stand than at the finish line of the Comrades Marathon. The largest, oldest, and most prestigious ultra race, that is, any race longer than the standard marathon distance of 26.2 miles, in the world, as the clock ticks down toward its rigid 12-hour cutoff. By the time the runners enter the cricket stadium in the coastal city of Durban, they've covered 56 miles of relentlessly undulating terrain, the downhills shredding their quads as mercilessly as the uphills burn their lungs under the fierce South African sun. In odd-numbered years, the course runs in the opposite direction, finishing in the inland city of Pietermaritzburg. In 2010, I joined thousands of other spectators in the stadium, counting down the final seconds as the race director assumed his position on the finish line, his back to the oncoming runners, and his starter's pistol pointed skyward. To be recorded as an official finisher of the race and receive a coveted finisher's medal, you have to cross the line before the 12-hour gunshot is fired. Summoning their final reserves of willpower, the runners within striking distance began to urge their battered legs into a final frantic sprint. As the gun cracked, one man staggered across the line in 11:59:59. Mere strides behind him, another man bounced off the burly course marshals who had linked arms to barricade the finish chute, while vuvuzelas sounded a mocking raspberry of defeat. I had come to South Africa on assignment for Outside Magazine to write about Tim Noakes's contrarian ideas about the brain. The hook for my story was the Comrades' debut of American runner Josh Cox, who was fresh off an impressive American record of 2 hours 47 minutes 17 seconds over 50K. I figured that if he conquered the distance, he and Noakes, who was also in Durban to watch the race, would be able to offer vivid insights into the nature of the limits he'd had to overcome. And if the distance conquered him, the story would be even better. The one guarantee in an event like this is the pain, Cox told me, all too prophetically, when we met for coffee the day before the race. You have to welcome it, say, here you are, my friend. But Cox's hopes fizzled just a few miles into the race, thanks to recurring bouts of stomach cramping and diarrhea that slowed him to a walk. As familiar as this debacle might be to marathoners, these were not the limits I was hoping to write about. The story was eventually killed. Still, the race had given me a perfect excuse to make a pilgrimage to one of the temples of modern exercise physiology. The next day, I flew to the opposite end of the country to spend a week visiting Noakes's lab at the University of Cape Town. At 60, Noakes had graying temples, a near-permanent grin that expressed everything from disbelief to delight, and a habit of punctuating his sentences with the all-purpose interjection, "Yeah." His fourth-floor office had a postcard view of Table Mountain's iconic ridgeline, and a museum's worth of sports memorabilia, framed clippings, signed rugby shirts, battered old Onitsuka Tiger running shoes,